I checked with Ajahn Brahmali in the discourse of the Buddha whether he made any statements regarding how many days when you passed away that you stay around. Because there's this traditional belief in the Thai tradition that's around 49 days. And Ajahn Brahmali says there is no quote regarding the number of days. But he does said in the sutta where I think in the one of the baskets that when the person passes away, the relatives can still make merit by dedicating, you know, to make good karma for the deceased by dedicating the merits of their good action to the dead relatives. So there's something you can do after they passed away, but the time, it wasn't specified in the sutras anywhere, okay? So that's the loose ends. And, yes, Chiwei? Yes, I. Regarding the, thank you for reminding me. The other issue was that when the Buddha sat down at the Bodhi tree and to you know become enlightened, he went through the four jhanas. So it's after the four jhanas that the enlightenment happened. You don't need all eight. And the last four jhanas are actually called the immaterial attainments. So it's more refined. It's not exactly going, you know, upwards. Okay? So it's the fourth jhanas that you need to become enlightened. Just remember that. And there's a few questions here, but I thought I'd give a talk about enlightenment. A few words about it anyway. Obviously, there's a big, caution that only, you know, it's something beyond word. Only enlightened ones really understand what it's all about. All we can do is give similes, stories, quotes, what the enlightened being said about the experience. But it's something for each and every one of us to really to experience ourselves. And it's confusing sometimes because people describe the experience very differently. But I think that's just mainly words. The experience is, you know, like I said, ultimately the same. Okay? And that also, yes, there's lots of questions, and I'm happy to answer, to make it as clear as I can, to inspire, to encourage. But basically, the answer, is not in here, certainly not in myself. The answer is for each and every one of you to discover that for yourself, right? The truth of the Dhamma is something to be realized in each and every one of our minds. And the path of practice is also something that each and every one of us has to walk by ourselves. Okay, the teacher can only encourage, inspire, but basically something you have to take in our own hearts and mind. Okay, so enlightenment. What's this enlightenment? Different ways to describe it. Buddha said at different places many things, but one of the things he did point out was it's the highest happiness, right? The highest happiness. When Sariputta asked, "What is happiness? What is suffering?" He answered, to be reborn, that is suffering. And not to be reborn is happiness. So it points to where this enlightenment takes us, right? It's not to another heavenly realm, another wonderful place that we can exist forever and ever, but it's the end of existence as we know it, right? Yes, it may sound like cosmic suicide. It sounds like, annihilation. But the Buddha points out, it's nothing here to annihilate. What we have here is just, a body-mind process, not a self, not a being. So that's why it's not annihilationism. It's just a ceasing, extinction, passing away. Okay, so that's some of the things that are said in the Buddha, in the suttas. But then, obviously, food for thought. There are other schools of thoughts regarding Nibbana, and some teachers do say that there is something outside of the five khandhas that you attain to or whatever when you become enlightened. Whatever it is, it doesn't matter. It's something that, like I said, each and every one have to experience for ourselves. But regardless what the end product is, the teachers who teach always recommend the same path. It's an eightfold path. You have to go through the Four Noble Truths, and It starts with, you know, cultivating moral conduct, and you progress to stilling the mind, meditation, and you have to have, you know, absorption, you know, strong stillness of the mind. And there it goes, and then you get the wisdom that comes from that, that destroys the attachment. So the path of practice is, you know, the same. Whatever they advocating, what you see at the end of the road, okay? And what's the other thing I was going to say about Nibbana? It's a story of Ajahn Brahm. Most of you probably heard, but there's half of people who are new, so I'll try this story out. It's one of my favorite stories in Ajahn Brahm's book. It's called The Wishing Game, and it points to what Nibbana is about, right? The Wishing Game starts something like you have five little kids in a school, and have this wishing game, right? Who can outdo each other, right? So the first kid, you know, you have to wish. What do you wish for? So first kid, raise his hand quickly. First thing that comes to his mind, I want to have a McDonald's burger, right? It was 10 o'clock, he was hungry, so that's what came to his mind. He wanted a hamburger right away. It's like, okay, yeah, fair enough. But then the second kid raised his hand, had time to think about it. So he says, after thinking a little bit about it, you know, what's another wish? To outdo this hamburger, right? So he wishes that he would have a whole McDonald's franchise. That way he can have a hamburger anytime he wants. Every day, for the rest of his life, he can have hamburgers, right? Okay, so that beats the first wish. Then the third kid thinks about, okay, how to outdo this guy, right? How to do hamburger every day? He thinks about it, he raises his hand, says, I've got an idea, something to beat that. What would beat that? He says, I wish to have $1 billion. That way I can buy my own chain of McDonald's, a chain of ice creams, a toy factory, car factory, whatever I want I can buy with $1 billion, right? And he says, okay, that's pretty smart, that's pretty good. So he beats that. So the fourth kid thinks, okay, how to outdo this, right? How to outdo $1 billion when you can buy anything you want? That's what most people strive for, right, in the world. To make enough, to buy whatever you want, to go on holidays, new cars, new house, whatever you want with money that buys power, buys wealth, maybe even buys youth and beauty. That's what the magazine says anyway. But anyway, so the fourth thing is, okay, how to beat this? And he raises his hand. I got it. I know how to beat $1 billion. He says, I wish to have that I have three wishes. So first wish, McDonald's. I get my burger right away. I get my burger right away. Second wish, I wish to have, you know, whatever, $1 billion. And the third wish, I wish to have another three wishes. So, unlimited amount of wish, right? That's even better than $1 billion. Whatever we want, we get right away, right? To have the wonderful partner, to live forever, maybe even, right? To be always happy, right? So we think happiness comes from getting what we want. So you have an unlimited amount of wish. That should bring, you know, eternal happiness almost. So how can you beat an unlimited amount of wish? The fifth kid, a very quiet kid, he thinks a while, and he raised his hand. And he says quietly, oh, I think I have a wish. If I had a wish, I wish that I was so content I would never need a wish. And that was the future Buddha. And that's what enlightenment is about, right? You're so content, you never need anything. So that's what it leads to. It doesn't lead to more things, this enlightenment business. Enlightenment leads to slowing down the stillness of the mind and the emptiness that comes from not wanting, not wishing, not moving, managing, controlling, right? So that points to direction. That's what Nibbana, that's what we're striving for. We're not striving to be a better person, a better self, a bigger self. Sometimes we come to meditation, come to spiritual practice, and we're engaging in practice of selfing. You know, I'm going to be a good meditator, a good Buddhist. Like, really keep the pure precepts better than the next guy. Very next girl I sit next to it. I do more retreats than other people. Get more nimittas that I can tell my friends about. Right? We're always looking for another experience. You know, even meditation can be a bit of a spiritual consumerism. Another experience to have, right? You look in the newspaper, in the magazines, that's what they're advertising. More experience, the better. You know, 10 things you have to do before you die. You know, whatever. You know, hang glide over the Grand Canyon, bungee jumping off the, you know, whatever, the rock, skydiving, whatever. You know, different things that you have to do. You know, have coffee in on the top of the Mayan ruins. Right? There's things that you have to have to do. To be a fulfilled life, you have to have this experience. You have to fall in love. You have to raise a kid. It's like, no, you don't. So it's always more, and sometimes we approach kind of spiritual life is like that. I want to get the more, you know, the first jhana is good. But I want the second jhana, third and the fourth. Something to remember, to gauge my progress by. Something to tell my friends. Sometimes we're sitting here, and we have this kind of postcard mentality. Oh, I got to take a picture of this, and I got to tell my friends after I get out to discuss over the coffee table your great meditation experience that you have. And actually, it's going the opposite direction. It's about letting go. Whatever we see, experience, you know, meditation is about to learn. And Buddhism is to learn to understand the nature of experience. It's not to have another experience that you can talk about, but to understand, you know, this is what a distracted mind is like, and this is what a still mind is like. And so if we learn to understand the nature of experience, then we can let it go, right? To learn that all experience in the mental world, the physical world, the universe, is subject to three characteristics, right? It's impermanent. It is non-self, we cannot control it, and it's suffering. Right? So to understand that aspect of it is something that we're striving for. Right? Not necessarily to have another experience that we can hold up. We can tell a teacher and get a certificate, I did my 9-day retreat, I got the first jhana. Right? So just to remind people that we're here to learn about our experience, not to get another experience. Okay? So that's a few words on what Nibbana is about and what the purpose of the holy life, the practice. And then we'll go to the questions, otherwise it'll be a long night. Any questions or comments? Yes, Dania?
You mentioned, like, us.
Yes, you said cessation of the five khandhas, though. He didn't say cessation of, you know. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. There is something outside.
Yeah, possibly, no, it's true.
When
yeah.
I hear, like, outside, there's...
But there's always craving anyway. The people are going to crave and say, you know, oh, I want Nibbana, right? But you don't get to Nibbana by wanting anyway. Yeah, so it's true. I mean, it's the path of letting go. Yeah, okay. Well, that's the thing. That's why I say words is a bit up. Yeah. Because words don't get there. You can't get to that by thinking your way through it. Yeah. So that's why it's just kind of a strange concept. Yeah. Yeah, now they change it to awakening. Yeah. But like Nibbana is extinction, right? Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's the thing. Whatever it is end of suffering. And it's a path of increasing happiness. And also, just to say that it's true, Nirvana is not something you achieve after you die. It's something that you can realize in this very life, that you become enlightened and then very, very happy, and then you still, you know, live the rest of your kind of natural life until the life force expires. Yeah. So it's not something that you achieve or you get after you die. It's something that we can realize, we can experience in this very life if the conditions are right. No, because, right, we make the, It's a common thing. If you create enough spiritual qualities, and then these, you know, and your mind is still enough, then there can be a breakthrough. Yeah. But I'm, because the reason I said it was you realize that it can, means that there's a self in there somewhere. But these things just happen. Yeah. Okay. Okay. We should get to the questions. I don't want it to be a long night. Okay. Dear friends, dear friends, let me tell you how I feel. Okay. You have something special? Okay. A song from Plum Village. I think it goes together. Something about this, a song from Plum Village, Thich Nhat Hanh's Memento, but I don't have it. Okay. Oh, must be, yeah, must be that. Dear friend, let me tell you how I feel. You have something special. I love you so. That's a song from Plum Village, sorry. Okay. So that's a note. Okay. Oh, there we are. someone has a comment to make. For those interested, Buddha's enlightenment is described in the Machimara number 36, Mahasakya Sutta, and he went through the four jhanas I was saying before, and there was no mention of any body sensations or noting. So we'll just leave it at that. Okay, this is just something in the Buddha Rakita, but he's not here. So you... Oh, that's, I forgot to mention. Like I said, questions are good. I'm trying my best to make it... to clarify and to make it in a way that's easy to understand. But like I said, and to inspire, to encourage. But... the most important part of the retreat is not what happens between 8 and 9. It's what happens between 5 in the morning and 8 o'clock. It's what happens when, you know, you're sitting there looking at your breath and working through your anxieties, your anger, your frustrations, your memories. That's the most important bits, okay? This is just a lot of hot air and entertainment. So... Huh? Because it's just, it's something, right? It's just to give people a start. But basically, the real work is, yeah, it's something we sit with it. Yeah. And it's, like I said, people, sometimes in the retreat, people can get a bit serious, a bit focused, and it's just, we're just kind of, you know, allow people to relax a little bit, to have a nice sleep. Okay, Venerable, heartfelt thanks for a wonderful, refreshing retreat. Thank you for your openness and the clarity you bring to the Dhamma. The guided meditation were a treat. Mount is the metta to you and all the Venerables who were part of this retreat. It's very kind. And from an unknown author, when we desire truth more than survival, fear ends. That's very nice. So when we desire truth more than survival, fear ends. Okay. Dear sir, I love to go fishing with my mates, but ever since coming across Buddhism, I'm more wary of the future consequences of my actions. Ah, very good. Yes. Having said that, every time the opportunity arises to go fishing, my love for the sport outweighs any fear of future repercussions. I feel I'm slowly coming around, but do you have anything to add? Thanks. Yeah, it's, I mean, it's all about conditioning. So obviously, you know, you have been conditioned to, you know, to like to go fishing and the good times associated with that. But also, as a meditator, you come into, you know, across that. You can also develop your ability to empathize with beings. So imagine yourself, you know, stuck on a hook. How is that going to feel? and a lot of times we don't. We do things that hurt and harm other people because we think, well, you know, it doesn't feel the same. But with meditation, you know, the idea of, you know, it shouldn't be very difficult to put yourself in other people's kind of shoes. And what's it? and to find skillful ways to around these kind of social issues, like either drinking with your buddies or doing fishing or hunting that would harm other beings, right? And also, yeah, there is a point in life where you have to make the decisions. I'm going to go towards the wholesome state of harmlessness. I'm going just to continue these habitual tendencies of the mind that I've inherited. Any questions or comments? Yes, Bert?
You can fish without a hook.
That's right. Ajahn Brahm's favorite advice. Go fishing, but don't put any hook in your fishing stick.
That's why I fish
inside. So there you go. Very nice suggestion. You can go, what is it? Fishing on the internet. Virtual reality fishing. Yeah, but these are the friends, I think. Yeah, they might not be into meditation if they're fishing. Yes, any other questions or comments? That's right, very good. Dear Venerable, it has been a great retreat so far. If none of us gets into jhanas, may we all at least make peace with our sloth and torpor, the metta. There you go, that's a very wise meditator. Whatever it is, just to make peace. And then jhanas might happen, right? You still have a whole night and half a day to tomorrow when you least expect it. Dear Ajahn Kemawaro, this question is asked with the fullest respect to the Dhamma teaching. Did the Buddha disclose comments on the benefits of people having children in order to give beings the opportunity to incarnate to continue their journey of purification with metta? So the question is, did the Buddha disclose comments on the benefits of people having children in order to give beings the opportunity to incarnate to continue the journey of purification? I cannot remember. He does give lots of advice to householder, to people who have families and wives and stuff like that. But I don't remember him encouraging married couples to have children. He encouraged them to be, faithful to each other and to do things, wholesome things together, to practice generosity, to practice meditation, and to go to the monastery together and stuff like that. So he does encourage that aspect of it. But I don't remember him encouraging having more babies. And also we have to remember that, I guess you were born into the human realm is, according to the Buddha, is the best way to become enlightened. So I was going to say there are other realms that beings can be born into, the animal realms, the heavenly realms. But no, I don't remember. But does anybody remember Buddha saying anything about being born? Not specifically. And also because he does give a teaching where he said that, and this is a powerful teaching of most people, when I read it, it's hard to swallow, especially if you have kids and you live a household life. He says, suffering arises from what is dear to you. Right? So you have kids, wife, possessions. We think, oh, it's great, I have a big house, I have lots of kids to love me, I have my wonderful wife, I have a wonderful husband. But he says that those are the very thing that causes suffering because our attachment to them. And he gives this great simile. He says, you hear someone, a modern interpretation of that, you read about people, having car accident, dying all the time. But it doesn't, we don't suffer over that. You read a newspaper, whatever, people die, we're slightly sad, but it doesn't shake us. But when our own loved ones are in a car accident, that's totally different. And what is the difference? There's still a human being dying, but we suffer so much more. So it's a very lucid teaching on what is happiness, what is suffering, what is attachment. Yeah. So if anything, having kids, you already have them, obviously take care, be good parents, but to go out, to get more kids, I think I don't remember recalling him recommending that anywhere. Yes? Yeah, and to He didn't talk, and there was no questions regarding in terms of the sexuality. I see, obviously, it is within the realms of marriage to have sex with your partners. That's right. Yeah, he certainly didn't discourage that. He says, you know, there are duties that a husband does to a wife, and wife does to a husband, he certainly didn't celebrate it like modern Buddhists these days, that you have to have it to reach enlightenment. You go and, you know, this kind of, what is that, tantric sex? It's like, it's not anywhere in the sutras. But not to say I don't know, you know, enough about the other traditions, but certainly not discussed in the sutras, the Buddhist words anywhere. Yeah. Okay. And that's kind of the rub. Most people want, yeah, we want to become enlightened, but we also want everything else that comes with it. You know, there's a lady in England who asked Ajahn Chah, you know, yes, I want to become enlightened, but do I have to give up sex? It's like, well, it should be obvious once you start practicing that it stirs up the mind, the feelings that we have. Yeah? And that there are much more wholesome feelings we can have towards our partners other than just kind of these physical desires that come to. Okay. Moving on. Dear Ajahn, every now and again, one of my friends decides to get married, and I'm invited to his Bucks Night. In most cases, my friend's Bucks Night normally involves strippers, booze, and general misbehavior. If I decide to attend the Bucks Night party, we'll be breaking the third precept involving sexual misconduct. Thanks. It depends if you have a partner and that you indulge in, obviously, sexual conduct with another person. That would be obviously breaking the third precept. Yeah. And also not to say the fifth precept that you're drinking as well. And that's more of an important precept, because once you become, you know, drunk, the other four precepts kind of go out the window pretty quickly. So, yeah. Yeah, is that clear? Any more questions or comments? Dear Ajahn, it's easy to display patience, kindness, generosity, and understanding towards our friends, those we like. But how do you suggest we practice this with those that we do not like and find very irritating? As I find this very difficult, you're able to teach all of us with patience, kindness, and attentiveness, regardless of our behavior. And it seems easier to not treat these people so well, so they stay away from us. Thank you so much. You are a very wise, kind, peaceful, inspirational teacher. No, that's where you can see the practice comes in. Yes, it is very easy to be patient and to be nice to your friends. But it's when people irritate us that we see, you know, how peaceful we really are and how kind we are. And that's why the practice of, you know, metta meditation, practice of loving kindness, of friendliness. Although we start with the people we like, our loved ones first, we do hopefully build up the resilience to start spreading to people that we don't know so well, not so thrilled about, and the people that we have difficulty with. Because, you know, it's something that's kind of preparing us to live, you know, a harmonious life. Because in life, in the world, we're going to meet people that we don't like. We're going to meet people that will irritate us. But, you know, Lumpo Lim, you know, a very wise monk, always says, you know, be grateful for the people that irritate you. Because they allow you to see where your attachment is, where, you know, how much more patience we can practice. Allows us to practice kindness, generosity to the people that irritate us. They make us see, you know, what areas of our practice we need to focus on. We're around people that we like all the time, that say the right thing, that pleases us. Then we don't get to see, you know, how deep is our practice, really, right? So that's something to keep in mind, actually. The people that irritate us are the ones that are very good teachers. Like Ajahn Chah also said, you know, the mosquitoes in the forest that bite you all the time, those are our teacher. Call them, you know, Ajahn mosquitoes, which means, you know, teacher mosquitoes. Because they bring to mind the uncomfortableness of having a body. Right? See, it brings to mind our attachment to comfort. Right? Then they start to challenge that, they make us uncomfortable. Yeah. Questions or comments? Dorothy? No, it's true. It was a good comment that the qualities that we don't like in other people usually is a mirror to own the qualities in ourselves that we don't like. And so it's a good point to bring up, to reflect, why is this person annoying me? And also, living in a community is great because you can see these dynamics work themselves out. You know, there's 20 people in the room, 20 monks or 20 nuns, whatever, in the ropes. And usually it's one person that annoys you more. And you can say, well, you know, because he's sloppy or he's whatever. But then he doesn't annoy other people. So you can say, well, see, obviously it's not the same for everybody. That is our own personal issues that comes up when we get annoyed. Because even an obnoxious person doesn't annoy everybody equally. There's one or two that, you know, he does his rounds with. And there's something, you know, that comes out. Yeah? Any questions or comments? Well, that's the thing. That's why I said, you know, just to like Lungpo Lim said, yeah, the comments was that these people push up buttons. So it's our job to find out, yeah, to unscrew it, to find ways to deal with that, and to work with the noise that comes up, because it's just part of living in any community, anywhere, that you're going to have people that, you know, annoy you and have people that you like, and just work with the likes and dislikes. Is what the spiritual path is about. Is the nimitta affected by the lighting conditions, day or night, etc.? Yes, you stare into a light bulb long enough, you get a really beautiful nimitta. But it only lasts for about a few seconds. And there's no happiness that comes from it. Well, at least you have an idea what nimittas are like. Nimittas, generally, darker is better if you are, you know, it was the beginning stages, but not really. If your mind is still, you know, you can actually see the nimitta in daylight, right? So yeah, so it's not really affected by light that way. But you are, like I said, nimitta doesn't always mean the mind is peaceful or you're close to jhanas. Some people, as I said in interviews, are more visual than others. They, as soon as they close their eyes, within a few minutes, they see things already, you know, a light or shape. So it's not so important what you see. It's the emotional content of your awareness. Is it peaceful? Is it still? A lot of happiness comes up. Yeah. So it's not so important whether it's a nimitta, but the fact that you're feeling peaceful and content, then just stay with that. No need to start looking around, you know, where's my nimitta or whatever. Where's, you know, is it a bright nimitta? Is it a golden nimitta? Is it a deep blue or whatever? Just to stay with the emotional content with the meditation. More peace, better. More contentment, then you're heading in the right direction. Is there snakes? Dew guides in the forest. I haven't seen one, but is there? Oh, yeah, I see, yeah. Not in this time, it's too cold anyway. But there are snakes probably in the forest during the summers, I'm sure. Yeah, yeah. So I recommend staying on the main path, use flashlights, torches when you're moving around, and it shouldn't be a problem. I think the whole time, well, not in this time, but Bodhinyana Monastery, there's lots of snakes, but no one's been bitten in the, 25 years we've been there, so far so good. Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, okay. It went out very peacefully and off into the dam. Oh, okay. So there you go. Bianca was saying a few retreats ago, there's a little snake in the kitchen. It also wants to be fed, I suppose. Yeah, usually if you walk up kind of noisily and just tap things around, generally they run away faster. Yeah, and also, like I said, it is, it's pretty cold, so they're pretty deep down in the ground, I think. Yeah. Yeah. Ajahn, I find lying down in meditation to be the most stable and comfortable position. or as long as I'm actually meditating, I don't get sleepy. Why don't we lay down in the sala? It's funny, it reminds me of a story. I taught my 9-day retreat last year in Norway. And one of the meditators, apparently he had a very deep meditation a few years ago when he was lying down. So now he asked for special permission to lie down. And luckily it's only nine retreatants during that retreat. But you know how it is when one person asks permission to lie down, they see him lie down. It's like everybody's lying down. So it didn't look very inspiring as all these people just lying there. It's like they're sleeping. But I think lying down is actually, one of the four postures. So, it's not, obviously it's something that people do get, can get meditation, good meditation from. But I think for most of us, lying down usually suggests that we're ready to go to sleep. And so the mind usually tends towards, sleepiness, sloth and torpor. But you find that lying down is helpful in your meditation, then I think you still can do that. But I think the general rule is just to lie down in your room. It's quiet, and you may not be disturbing people if you're lying down in the sala. And we have this thing as well, not pointing your feet at the Buddha statue as well. So not lying down this way. Yeah. But also lying down here can be very comfortable. It's pretty hard floor. So if you have a nice mattress in your room, it's probably much more conducive to lying down meditation. Yes, Dania? That's right, yeah, okay. Yeah, so the comment, you can't point your leg, you can feet. But generally, like I said, it is also an act of mindful, just to know where your body lies. Yeah, so there's no problem just pointing your feet the other way as well. Yeah, so your Ajahn Brahm's retreat, people can point their feet anywhere they want. And this retreat, point your feet that way. Dear Ajahn, more questions for Venerable Buddha Rakita. He's not here tonight. Yes, I want to also commend people. Well done, all the people who did the weeding and the cleaning up around the jhana grove. It's freshened everything up. Good karma. Yeah, just wanted to note appreciation. It was very good. All the people who could spend time kind of weeding and doing work around. And I was thinking of just talking, incorporating that into future retreats. This is a big place and it needs a lot of kind of maintenance. So a few hours of, 1 or 2 hours of physical work in weeding or cleaning the place is probably not a bad thing to incorporate that into our daily schedule. Yeah. Okay, thank you, thank you, thank you. All the Ajahn and friends. Love you all, honor you all. Oh, that's a very nice note. Dear Ajahn, can you please comment on one's mind, the type that wants to know everything about why it thinks this way or that way, why people and situation affect it so? Is this a case of curiosity killed the cat, metta? Yeah, sometimes we think curiosity is a positive thing, and to a certain extent it is, but also to recognize when it's just restlessness, that it wants to know about everything, every little thing you need to do or decide or look at, and just to know that it's not necessary, that actually having more information is not necessarily a good thing, because it can lead to distraction and confusion. And sometimes, we've gone, kind of this kind of a culture of knowing more is better. From a meditative point of view, not necessarily. More can lead to confusion and distraction. And not necessarily kind of a wholesome thing. And comment on one's mind. Just to see it as restlessness. And I would suggest to go to the body, feel it, why do I need to know everything, to understand everything for me to be content? And you said you don't have to know and understand everything in the world. You were saying the other day, there's many interesting things to know in the world, many fascinating topics to investigate and research. But at least know one thing first before you go investigating all the other wonderful stuff in the world. What is happiness and what is suffering? Get that out of the way first before you investigate the stars, the moon, the stock markets, or whatever else that comes into our mind. Right? Know what happiness is. Dear Arjan, technical question. Can you please explain what is meant by mental volition and consciousness, the last two of the five aggregates? In what way can we reflect on them as impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not self? Thanks. Mental volitions, I think that is the consciousness is vijnana, and mental volition is not the sankharas? Yeah, sankharas, which means it's will. I think one of the things that we can reflect on, will, you know, kind of chaitana, is that how we decide things. And that comes and grows, right? These things, you know, these mental conditions, even consciousness, what we're aware of, that also comes and goes. Right? We can't control how we decide things. We think, okay, yeah, one of my favorite examples is that, you know, we think we are the sole kind of arbiter of our life. We decide what to do. You go into a shop, you decide you like this shirt, and you buy it. You go into a hair salon, you say, okay, I like this style. It makes me look attractive, younger, whatever, and you choose it. But then why is it that when you look into old photo albums, everybody has the same hairstyle, right? The 60s, the lady has the big beehives, the guy is dressed in a certain way, those kind of thick glasses, and they all wear the same clothes, roughly. It's because of conditioning. So we don't really, it's not self. We don't really decide. It's just conditioning of the society around us, saying that what is attractive and how we should look, right? So that's why it's not self. And it's impermanence because these things change. Our mental conditions change from moment to moment, very quickly, right? And that's why it's unsatisfactory. Because these things, when we cannot control it, it changes very quickly. And that's why, you know, it brings suffering, stress, because we cannot control it. Yeah, any questions or comments?
Isn't there
in terms of art and creativity?
Yeah.
Right. Yes, but that's the thing. No, yeah, we think, okay, you know, my face, I have long hair is better or short hair. But you look in the old magazines, they all have the same type of hairstyle. So they, you know, don't really decide in that way, right? That's the way. Okay, moving on. Oh, yes, Mike?
Consciousness.
Well, I did say consciousness, awareness. That also changes. What we're aware of, right? You say we think, you know, control, you know, we think we choose what we're aware of, but that changes. And you know, in terms of, you know, I said don't think of a white horse with wings on it. Right? What do you think? White horse with wings on it. So that's the thing. It's suggestible. What we're aware of, what we think of. It's also conditioned in our mind. Is that good? Of awareness? Good question. Nifty might have a good question. Oh, Dana can answer. Dana, what's your suffering of awareness? I'm a suitor expert over here.
Well, when you meditate and
things disappear, that's right. And that's also by inference. It's only, consciousness only really disappears, you know, on a very subtle level of like the eighth jhanas. When you don't perceive anything, and most of us obviously won't have access to that data, but you can infer by the thoughts that come to the mind, different things, you know, that kind of go through our mind. When those things fade away, then happiness arises, right? Yeah. Thank you for that. Any questions or comments? After tasting the deep, tranquil peace of the present moment, Why does my mind still crave the cheap thought candy? It's a habit. We're used to that, you know. Even if, like I said, you know, healthy food is supposed to be good for us, but, you know, sometimes, you know, we like a bag of chips, right? Or whatever, junk food. Because habits that's what we're used to. Yeah. But also, the more and more you taste the deep and tranquil peace of the present moment, the more you get a feel for it, then the mind will incline away from thinking, naturally. It's not a will, a force of mind. It's something, you know, once we really understand, and we understand that this, you know, tranquil present moment is true happiness, then the mind won't go thinking so much. It's because we don't know, we don't understand, we haven't tasted what peace feels like, that we chase after sense impingement to fill our days with. Yeah. Dear Ajahn, would we be able to contact you in the future regarding meditation and spiritual matters? If we want to stay at your monastery, what would be the procedure with metta? Regarding meditation, spiritual matters, I think I do have email contact that for business that we process different things. But in terms of kind of a correspondence, I would just leave it until the next retreat when I come back. And also, we have wonderful Bodhinyan monastery right here with Ajahn Brahm and a host of other senior monks who is just across the street and in town. So you definitely can also contact them regarding any meditation and spiritual matters. Yeah. The Venerable Santuti here. And we want to stay at your monastery. Yes, there is a website that you can contact. It's wbd.org.au. And you can Google What Buddha Dhamma, and it has all the information regarding, you know, how to get there and what to do to stay there. Questions or comments? Hi, Ajahn. Much is said about the insight and wisdom which comes with jhana. Could you say something about the process of gaining wisdom and insight in earlier stages of meditation, please? Yes, you know, to further our stillness or peace, you can reflect on a different aspect of reality of things, like reflection on the body that is impermanent, you know, that is not self. Also, if the reflection is done regularly and done correctly, it does lead the mind to more peace, to more letting go, right? And then the more peaceful you are, the deeply you see into reality as well. So they kind of roll around each other. They complement each other. You don't have to wait until, you know, you get the first jhana to really to start to contemplate. You can contemplate along the way, and that will help to quiet the mind down. Contemplate the suffering in sense contact. Contemplate the drawbacks of sensuality. You know, we think, you know, whatever you think, a nice car is nice, but yeah, you have to work for it. You know, and it breaks down on you. You get bored with it after a few months. Just contemplate that. You can just desire where it leads us. Whatever we want, does it always lead to more happiness, or just, you know, it's just an illusion that happiness comes from getting things? So the more we contemplate along the lines of Dhammas, it should bring more peace and stillness. And more peace and still we are, the mind is, we can see deeply, more deep into the nature of things. Right? So those things spin around each other regarding the practice. Any questions or comments? The comments was that it reminds him of what Ajahn Brahm said about peeling the layers of the lotus back to get to the center petals. That's the thing. I think that the simile is regarding, you know, is the enlightenment, nirvana is in the center of the present moment. And the more still we are, you know, the closer we get to it. But also, yeah, and just to see the process is going deeper, to go inward more and more and deeply. And the insights that come, it's more beautiful, more subtle, Right, so the last few petals are, you know, like says, you know, very thin, barely there, but very, very beautiful and wonderful to behold. And then you get to the last petal, the inner thing, you see emptiness. Right? And that's also been the most wonderful petal once you get there, I suppose. Yeah. That's right. Always reminds me about, you know, saying something about enlightened beings as well. Yeah, thanks for reminding that. The comments was there are many schools in the U.S., that's kind of focused on vipassana as, you know, being enlightened through insight meditation only. From what I know and from the teachers I've come across, highly unlikely. You need the peace, the stillness of mind to really penetrate. Otherwise, you're just still thinking. You're still noting away, you know, how peaceful is that? It's got to be absolutely stillness of the mind. And they're still noting, it's thinking. Thinking is way too coarse, right? If you think you can think your way to nirvana, then, you know, all the universities, the Harvard, the Oxford, they've got lots of arahants walking around, but they don't, right? They've got just lots of professors with the headaches, probably, with thinking too much. No, but also to also remind people that the what is enlightened beings are like. And there's eight things or nine things that enlightened beings are not able to do, right? To kill a living being, once you're enlightened, that's out of the question. And to steal things, you know, to break your precept, to lie, that's also not in the realms of an enlightened mind. Enlightened beings are, by nature, right, free from ill will, free from greed, and free from delusion. So it's not that they're suppressing these thoughts. They just don't appear in the mind. So you have enlightened beings, and they look like they're angry, they look like they crave things, then it's unlikely that they're enlightened, right? And also, sexual intercourse is also out of the realms of enlightened beings. Those desires don't come up. It's not that they're suppressing it. They don't come up. So any enlightened beings who say they're enlightened, they have families, they have girlfriends, they have partners, you know, it's highly suspect because those things don't come up, right? So to know that, you know, anybody who indulges in luxurious stuff, drive around their Porsches or Rolls Royce, and they say, I'm still enlightened, I'm just not attached. Like Ajahn Chah said, you know, I'll give you lots of salt water to drink and tell me that's not salty. It's not, you know, you can't indulge in sensuality and not get caught up in it. That's impossible. If you don't have the desire, then you wouldn't be, you know, using luxurious things. You don't live in a nice house unless you find it comfortable, right? So yeah, some people might say great things when they sit up here and very articulate and very convincing, but if you look further into the conduct, that's the proof in the pudding whether they're enlightened or not. You start to challenge them on their theories and see, watch their behavior. You praise them to see whether that changes or not. So there's certain conduct of enlightened beings that are very clear in the suttas. So it's just not kind of, you know, hazy. Or it's not just kind of mumbo-jumbo regarding what enlightened beings, you know, you can do things and not be attached or whatever. That's just kind of clever talking. Yeah, any questions or comments? Okay, yes, Tom? Generally not, yeah. Yeah, certainly not to the public. As monks, anyway, there are rules that, you know, we cannot say. It's against the rules to tell other unordained people about our spiritual attainments, even jhanas or something you're not supposed to say. You can say to your friends, but yeah. Yes, Mike? Okay, yeah. That's why there's no fear. Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. That's right. And they all don't store things. So that's why I say, you see a mind being with a big house and, you know, a big pantry or whatever, you know, unlikely to be enlightened. And fear. And fear is the thing that kind of rules most people's mind. So it's interesting to know that, yeah, if they're afraid, they react out of fear, you know, then, yeah, it's a good chance that they're not enlightened. Certainly not fully enlightened. Yeah. Yeah, thanks for that. Yeah.
Why do we use the word fully?
Because there are different stages, right? There's first stage and yeah. Dear Ajahn, Ajahn Brahm describes the use of mantras like telling a taxi driver where to go every 2 seconds, whereby he will throw you out of his taxi. Do you agree, or do we need to be careful about using mantras? Thank you. Yeah, mantras, like anything, is a skillful means to kind of ground the mind in the present moment. And some people find it more useful, other people find it, it makes them too tense, then they always have to be, noting or saying things. So with any kind of skillful techniques, try it out for yourself and see whether that works or not. Yeah. And like I said, just to test that, whether you're feeling more stillness, more peace, or getting more tense. Getting more tense, then it's not probably not a good technique for yourself anyway. Yeah. But certainly many people have received, the fruits of just having a mantra. That way it cuts away the thinking, thoughts in the mind. And just saying one thing. So also saying anything that you find inspiring that points you towards peace and stillness and letting go. Could be very useful. Yeah. Questions or comments? Yeah, I think, that's the thing. In Buddhism, we are very kind of decentralized. There's no kind of, the Vatican, the Pope saying this is the party line. And basically teachers are kind of teach what they feel is appropriate. And some are better teachers than others. Some lead people towards, closer to enlightenment. Other people actually lead them away to their own delusion. So that's why. But also the power is not here, it's out there. You have to be the final arbiter of what works for yourself. Is it leading you towards wholesome states of mind, towards peace and letting go? Or is it leading you away from that? And judge teachers' practices according to that. Yeah. Right. Yeah, and always encourage people to ask questions if it doesn't make sense. When the monks look strange or they tell you something that doesn't make sense, just get clarifications. And we're quite happy to answer these things. Okay, last three questions. Maybe San Tuti wants to do. No? She'll wake you up. Dear Ajahn, quite frequently, I suffer some form of mental irritation, where it's caused by someone being a pain to me, or from me having unskilled speech towards someone else. I feel that this mental irritation is amplified in this retreat for something that was done or said up to a year and a half ago. I feel that it's a burden on my head. How can I let it go? Letting go is more of a skill and something we can practice. But I think, and different ways to approach it, the best way of letting go of irritations, either, yourself for doing something unskillful or another person for doing something unskillful, is practice forgiveness. Try to do it, at least, once a day. Just sit down and say, I forgive myself for anything I've done in the past that's unskillful, that may hurt other people intentionally, unintentionally. And also once you, and forgiveness is kind of an attitude of the mind, that once you learn to forgive yourself, you can forgive others and vice versa. So you want those hard people that hold on to grudges, you find it difficult to forgive other people, then it's also a good chance that you're also carrying, a lot of self-grudges towards yourself, things that you've done in the past that you cannot let go of. So forgiveness, do some metta meditations of friendliness, of well-wishing. May I be well, may I be happy. And then give yourself that kindness. And then when you learn to, give yourself kindness, you can also give to others. Yeah, so with irritation, the great antidote is metta. And yes, in the beginning, it's kind of sickly, saccharine, sweet, and we don't feel it's natural. But with anything, it's just, practice makes perfect. It's a case of fake it until you make it. Just say the nice things and just allow it to sink into the mind over time. Yeah. Because, the world usually, it doesn't encourage, forgiveness, letting go. It encourages, to fault find, to hold grudges, to set people right when they annoy us, to give them back what they deserve. So with this, you know, loving kindness and this forgiveness is something we have to develop. And then it's like a muscle in the mind that needs to be nurtured on a regular basis, yeah, before it takes hold. Yeah. Any questions or comments? Dear Ajahn, initially I thought this retreat would be conducted by Ajahn Brown. I know, I told you, money back guarantee. So. But now we can understand why you were selected for this. I wasn't selected. I was the only one, I think, available. So it's not like there was like 10 monks sitting there. And we had to go through interviews or anything. It was like, yeah, you're available. We can't find anybody else. Yeah, yeah, okay. So we are really thankful for your support and guidance. May you be able to purify your mind to the max within this very life. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, thank you for the note. Dear Ajahn, what is the relation between the watcher and the present moment? Is the watcher in the present, or is the present in the watcher? The watch is a present. Come on. You're watching, you can only watch in the present moment. So you have to watch whatever's happening, right? Like, and I try to ground people into the body more. That is much more a coarse object and much more something that's easier to notice. You can only feel in the present moment. You can't feel feelings in the body, you know, 2 minutes ago. You cannot feel your feelings. You cannot feel the sensation in the body, you know, 3 minutes ahead, right? So you cannot stray away from the present moment if you ground your awareness in the body. With, you know, knowing thoughts, yeah, you can. If you have sharp mindfulness, you just know the thoughts that are arising and just kind of know it without getting caught into the kind of the story, and also without trying to push it away, right? You know that these kind of, you know, kind of dialogues that happens in the mind, you know, the mental babbling that goes on, just to know it, and once you know that, that's the present moment. So to... what's the relationship between the watcher and the present moment? The watcher is just knowing, and the present moment is there, knowing things in the present moment, really. Does that make sense? Any comments or clarifications? So I would, like I said, encourage people to watch, to feel with your body more. That way it moves away from the thinking mind and more to, you know, solid reality, with all the different sensations, the pain, the itches, the vibrational feelings in the energies in the body. Because it grounds you in the here and now. Okay, so it's getting late. I'm sure your body is grounding you quite a bit with all the pains that come up. That is the last questions. Any more comments? Any further additional questions before? There's always the next retreat, you know. Yes, you are. Uh-huh. That's a question regarding numbness. If you feel numbness in your legs or, you know, your feet, is it a sensation that passes away, or is your body telling you something that it's stretched to the limits and that you should change your posture? Personally, I find that the numbness stays, but it doesn't mean you're doing kind of harm to your body if you keep on sitting. You can sit, you know, 3-4 hours and you feel numb and tingling. But once you stand up, the blood starts to circulate again, and there's no long-term damage as far as I'm aware of. Most people, I understand, you're in fairly good physical condition. You can sit still for 3-4 hours without really doing your knee in. But the pain and the numbness that comes up, yeah, that's just kind of part of the body process if you sit too long. But it's not doing any long-term damage. But like anything, you have to experiment for yourself. You know, sit for a while and not move, and then get up and see what happens. If you do get up and you find the pain persists, you know, a day, a week or something, then you probably should move. Next time you feel numbness in your leg. Yeah? But if you stand up and you walk around 5 minutes and the pain disappears and it's no problem, then it just means, okay, the body's just playing up when you're sitting. And that numbness is not an issue for you. Yeah. Questions or comments? So tonight is a full moon night. And
An eclipse.
And an eclipse, is it? That's what I thought, because I only saw half a moon. I was like, I'm cheated. Okay. But it passed away, did it? When I was coming, it was half full. I don't know whether it's going towards full or it's moving away. Okay, yeah, so it's passed away, so we've got our full moon back. So like I said, and an invitation for people who are feeling up to it to sit further, to maybe to midnight. And like I said, it's encouraged, but highly optional. And just to, allow you to play with the limits of your, what you think you are capable of. But also, there's a right way to do it. You know, just don't do it because everybody's sitting here and, oh, no, I don't want to be embarrassed and I want to leave. Do it, as an offering to the Buddha, as an offering to all the teachers that you met. You know, do it out of faith, out of inspiration. But try to not do it from a sense of self, that because you've been an old hand, you've been meditating, 10 years, 20 years away, and now you're going to show everybody how straight you sit. And that is the path towards lots and lots of suffering. But so I encourage you to experiment. You see what we think, how much energy, how much sleep we need, or how much we don't need. So to keep that in mind. And you can decide yourself whether you want to continue sitting or call it, a night. But there will be no morning chanting tomorrow, because then maybe most people will stay in. And but brekkie is still at 6:45. I understand. Yeah. So thank you for your questions, and really the interviews was very, very touching. And I'm just really happy just to be back here and to be part of the process. Helping people to experience, to experience more peace and stillness in the mind, and also encouraging people to continue on their spiritual path, however they can. So thank you for being part of the journey.